This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If the Security Council then is democratized, in other words, you add more seats and you give Africa more seats, then the broader question is, what kind of powers will these new permanent seats have? Will they have veto powers?
That's David Manda, professor of political science at City University of New York, on the push to give Africa's a bigger voice in the UN's most powerful body, the Security Council. Details coming up. Also, talks on Sudan's 16-month-old civil war begins in Geneva. And there are allegations that freedom of the press is being threatened in Senegal. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story as talks on Sudan's 16-month-old civil war and the country's humanitarian crisis begin in Geneva. A group of Sudanese youth meeting in Nairobi has expressed support and hope. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
A group called the Sudanese Youth Network called for an immediate ceasefire to be signed in Geneva between Sudan's rival military factions to save millions of lives. Kefaya Ahmed is a member of the Sudanese Youth Network.
We wanted to highlight and to talk more about our social media campaign, Ceasefire Now for Sudan, and trying to raise our voice to let other people to know what is going on and them to support the Geneva talk, and also to pray that two parties of the war to ending the war of Sudan and to go to Geneva and to sit together and try to ending the suffering of the Sudanese and to try to bring the peace of Sudan.
Members of the group spoke with journalists today in Nairobi. The United Nations says the humanitarian situation in Sudan is at a catastrophic breaking point as famine and floods add to the challenges millions of people face in the world's largest displacement crisis following 16 months of conflict. Ahmed was optimistic that the Geneva peace process will bring an end to the crisis.
We Sudanese expectation maybe this talk will make difference because it is very comprehensive. It is trying to pressure for the two parties of the war to sit together and to negotiate it, including the participation of youth and women as a part of the negotiation of the talk agenda.
The United States has invited leaders of the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, to discuss establishing a ceasefire. However, the Sudanese army has refused to attend the talks. Mohamed Murukaz is another member of the Sudanese Youth Network.
As a Sudanese, we have the right to live. Even the warlord ignores us. We must not stop knocking on every available door.
Murukaz says restrictions on humanitarian access, including impediments imposed by parties to the conflict, have curtailed the ability of aid organizations to save lives.
We see that talk is an opportunity to stop the war and relieve the immense suffering of Sudanese people. We call for an immediate ceasefire to be signed to save Sudanese lives. We call for the international support to address the critical humanitarian needs in the country.
The conflict has displaced nearly 10 million people across the Greater Horn of Africa country and left 26 million facing crisis-level hunger. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Geneva peace talks, which the United States has organized, are being held in a secret location for security reasons. Officials have indicated since the Sudanese army is not taking part, the talks will focus on humanitarian access and on achieving local ceasefires to allow in aid. Sierra Leone's president used the UN Security Council presidency to urge more seats for Africa. President Julius Maada Bio, who chaired a council meeting Monday, said Africa cannot wait any longer to get a bigger voice in the UN's most powerful body. His push included seeking two permanent and potentially veto-wielding spots. David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy whether this push is feasible.
I think it's feasible, but the question is, will the five permanent members who are there currently want to give up their power? So it's feasible, but not practical. I also say that in regards to Africa, 55 countries, and between them, they haven't decided, even if you're to have those two permanent seats, what country is going to get them. Will it be Nigeria or Egypt? Will it be South Africa or Kenya? Will it be Algeria or Tunisia? How do you distribute those seats? And then the other question also is, if the Security Council then is democratized, in other words, you add more seats and you give Africa more seats, then the broader question is, what kind of powers will these new permanent seats have? Will they have veto powers? And, you know, how will they be distributed? Because right now there's an odd number of seats. So if Africa is given two seats, Asia will also need to be given more seats, Latin America, and probably the Europeans will want more seats. So it's a very good debate. It's an important debate to have. I'm not sure that the permanent members of the Security Council will be willing to give up their power right now and expand the number of permanent seats on the Security Council.
But the upcoming UN Summit of the Future and the annual General Assembly gathering of presidents, prime ministers, and monarchs next month are supporting the latest draft of the summit's potential Pact for the Future, terms Security Council reform a priority and pledges an ambitious result with specific language still to come. What's your take on that?
A lot of this language seems very repetitive because we've had a lot of these things being said in the past about Security Council reform, about the future of the UN. But I think the important part of a lot of these conferences is to continue to have these debates. Rome was not built in a day. So even if Africa doesn't get those two permanent seats tomorrow, at least the questions are being raised. I think there's a broader question, even if it's not implemented in practice, to give these regions of the Global South power on the Security Council. I think it raises a normative and a moral question about global norms and reforming the Security Council to be reflective of the realities of the world in 2024, because currently Security Council is reflective of the world in 1945. Russia and China are trying to create an alternative model to the neoliberal democratic order of the US and the West. So will China and Russia push for these reforms? I think this is why these debates are important to continue to have.
But the African continent has the world's fastest growing population now at 1.3 billion. The continent's 54 countries make up 28% of the UN member states, and five of the UN's 11 current peacekeeping operations are in Africa. Namibia's foreign minister, Faya Moshilinga, told the council on Monday that the permanent seats in particular must be urgently addressed.
These are important conversations to have. Africa would be able to push its agenda more aggressively forward if the African Union can have more collaboration and cooperation with other regional bodies of the Global South that have common interests for these countries which are excluded in the Security Council.
That was David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy. Following the victory of his protege, Bassir Diomaye Faye, in Senegal's presidential election this year, Ousmane Sonko was appointed prime minister. With their ascension, Senegal was praised as a bastion of democracy for the region. Now, 4 months later, the Senegalese Council of Press Distributors and Publishers says freedom of the press under the new leadership is under threat. Sonko has justified government action to crack down on the media by saying news outlets were writing whatever they wished without reliable sources in the name of press freedom. John Makum Mbaku, non-resident senior fellow for Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution, talked to me about the importance of press freedom and how those in power often want to control it.
To stand from the outside and protest what is happening in government, but when given the opportunity to govern, it becomes a little bit more challenging for people who previously have been protesting government corruption, government incompetence, government impunity. Once they themselves become part of the government, they begin to realize that governing is not as easy as what they thought it was. So this is a big problem that we have with a lot of regimes in Africa, including people who previously were not in government, but who wanted openness and transparency in government. Once they have an opportunity to participate in government as leaders themselves, all of a sudden they don't want that openness and transparency which they had preached in favor of for many years.
Yes. They are using a more diabolical approach here, and that is why I just had to get an explanation from you. For instance, they are freezing the bank accounts of the media companies. They are seizing production equipment, unilateral and illegal termination of advertising contracts, freezing of payments, approach to actually exterminating the media.
Yeah, that type of censorship, I've seen it in several other African countries, and it was not designed to improve press freedom. It was designed to destroy the press. So if the government argues that it is trying to improve the press, what they are doing is not going to improve the press. Because when you seize the asset of a newspaper, you are not improving the ability of that newspaper to function more effectively. You are basically trying to run them out of business. And that is not something that a democratic system should be doing. So if you destroy the press, you are basically destroying your democratic system. So if this is what the new president in Senegal is doing, he is basically destroying the democratic system that brought him to power. And that is not good. It's not good for Senegal at all. It's not good for Africa. And it should not be allowed to continue to happen. The press is very important for the maintenance of law and order, for the maintenance of the democratic system. And if you believe that, if you are the president and you believe that the press is not doing its job properly, there are better ways to handle that than to try to destroy it.
And Professor, you know, 3 years of arrests and violence against journalists under the presidency of Macky Sall, and now nothing has improved with Bassirou Diomaye Faye and actually the Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko.
The new regime is doing is not contributing to that kind of participation, to that kind of inclusion, to that type of democratic participation that would have allowed Senegal to stand out in Africa, especially in the region, in a region that is pervaded by very bad governance, military coups. Senegal was supposed to stand out as an example for the rest of the region. Unfortunately, it appears this is not what is happening.
That was Makoub Mbaku, non-resident senior fellow for Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution, speaking with me from the U.S. state of Utah. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Critics of Vice President Kamala Harris have used her gender as a cudgel, saying both subtly and overtly that a woman cannot hold the most powerful job in the free world. Gender scholars say those railing against Harris have also chosen another line of attack, her race. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Vice President Kamala Harris's quest for her nation's highest office has run headlong into a barrage of sexist attacks, hammering her love life, her clothing, and even her distinctive laugh. All classic hallmarks, experts say, of misogyny. Harris seeks to flip this narrative, which has persisted for more than a century since the first time an American woman ran for president. But scholars say Harris faces an additional challenge that she can't escape, her mixed race. Here's former President Donald Trump, the Republican presidential nominee.
She was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
This, scholars say, is a textbook case of misogynoir. Nadia Brown is professor of government and the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at Georgetown University.
Misogynoir is the horrible hybrid between sexism and racism that is specifically lobbed against Black women. And it's rooted in stereotypes about and against Black women, as well as them, these notions that they don't adhere to white heteropatriarchal supremacist norms.
These ad hominem attacks have prompted even some of Harris's harshest Republican critics to try to reel in the narrative. Republican Mike Johnson is Speaker of the House.
This is not personal with regard to Kamala Harris, and her ethnicity or her gender have nothing to do with this whatsoever.
Scholars say there is a groundswell of support for women sticking to more traditional roles in society, as seen in the burgeoning Instagram-friendly tradwife movement, which sees women's roles as homemakers, mothers, and helpmeets. But some women voters dismiss these gendered attacks as ridiculous. Salinas Nash is a California voter.
That's the sexist people. That's all for men. That's all. They said that even when Miss Clinton was trying to run, they were like, oh no, she's a woman. What if she have a period? She's going to start a war.
Georgetown University's Brown theorizes that Trump is using personal attacks because he fears meeting Harris face to face on the debate stage. In recent days, Harris and Trump have sparred on social media, accusing each other of dodging a debate planned for September 10th. Trump made the first move, calling instead for a September 4th debate, hosted by his favorite news network. Again, Nadia Brown.
I think that's probably a smart move on Trump's behalf, given that Kamala Harris is a former prosecutor, and what we've seen, everything we've seen about her and her debate performances leads many people to believe that she will mop the floor with Donald Trump.
Since women won the right to vote in 1920, their presence at presidential polls has risen. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
As Africa's Olympic athletes headed home from Paris, sports fans on the continent could not help but wonder what might have been. While African countries claimed dozens of medals in Paris, seven African-born and raised athletes won medals for other countries. One woman who tried for years to make Kenya's national team won the 3,000-meter steeplechase for Bahrain. Experts warn that a lack of investment in sports and other issues could prompt more African athletes to switch nationalities. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
African teams won a total of 38 medals at the Paris Olympics. Kenya won the most with 11. But Kenya could have claimed another gold had one of her athletes not chosen to represent Bahrain. Winfred Yavi won gold in the 3,000 metres women's steeplechase and even broke the Olympic record. Yavi told Kenyan media that she changed her nationality in 2014 after failing to get picked for the Kenyan team on several attempts. Her coach, Gregory Kilonzo, who has also been coaching athletes for Bahrain, told VOA there are a lot of incentives that can lead one to represent another country.
We are in Bahrain, we go direct for the Olympics or for the Ocha Water, and we don't go for trials because there are not many. Kenya, we go national, we go trials, then Bahrain, they pay well also. And they are serious with their athletes. They take care of their athletes. They pay salary every month for the athletes. If you come sick, they take you to countries for medical.
Hammer thrower Annette Ichikunwoke was denied a chance to represent Nigeria at the 2020 Tokyo Games because of Abuja's non-compliance with drug testing requirements. This year, she decided to compete for the United States and brought home a silver medal. Meanwhile, Nigerian athletes competed in 12 events in Paris and returned home without a single gold, silver or bronze. Nigerian officials apologized for the dismal performance and said they will review how people are elected to lead the sporting federation. Other athletes have left Africa to escape poverty, violence or political oppression. Sifan Hassan, an Ethiopian native, fled her country as a refugee and settled in the Netherlands in 2008. She has since won 3 Olympic golds for her country, including the women's marathon last Sunday in Paris. African athletes who have changed allegiance have complained of a lack of good sporting facilities that cater for their training needs, a lack of good pay, and corrupt officials favouring some athletes over others. Richard Wanjohi is a researcher with the African Sports and Creative Institute, an organisation that supports African sports through research, advisory and advocacy. He says the trend of African athletes abandoning their birth countries is worrying and may affect African performance in future competitions.
We are seeing younger people that more established names coming through, and that was the case with the recently completed Olympic Games. So you see people transitioning maybe between 18 to 21 years, and that's, you know, considerably young, even in the athletics or space or in some of the sporting disciplines that they compete in. The third one is the loss of talent from a national perspective, because, you know, once these individuals move, then you're not able to get representation as a country, or even when you have representation, it's not the best of the talent that you'd have.
To prevent promising athletes from leaving, sports fans on the continent want officials to spot talent among school-age children and give them the training they need to compete on the global stage. Some observers say African countries also need to invest in sports science and technology. To date, most countries have relied on natural advantages, such as East Africa's high altitude, to train its athletes. Retired middle-distance runner Martin Kane of Kenya says such methods may not work in the future.
If our countries can invest in, you know, the sports science, you know, and the technology, because technology has a huge impact on sports. And if a nation doesn't utilize particularly technology, you know, you aren't competitive in the global stage.
If Africa fails to harness the power of sports science, Kano says, African athletes will fail to win medals and may not even make it to the finals. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
A Ugandan court has convicted a former commander in the feared Lord's Resistance Army, LRA, on multiple counts of crimes against humanity after the first such war crimes trial in the East African country. Thomas Kuelo was abducted by the LRA at age 12 and became a low-level commander. He faced 78 counts related to crimes committed during the LRA's bloody two-decade rebellion and has been waiting for years behind bars for a verdict in the landmark case. The French news agency AFP reports that the lead judge says Coelho was convicted of 44 offenses that included murder, rape, torture, pillaging, abduction and destruction of settlements for internally displaced people. He was found not guilty of 3 counts of murder, and 31 charges were dismissed. The LRA was founded by self-styled prophet Joseph Kony in the 1980s with the aim of establishing a regime based on the Ten Commandments. More than 100,000 people were killed and 60,000 children abducted in a reign of terror that spread from Uganda to Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Central African Republic. Two South Korean missionaries were shot dead in northern Korea near the border, northern Kenya, near the border of Ethiopia, while 8 Kenyans were gunned down in a separate incident in the region. The Standard newspaper quoted Marsabit County authorities as saying, a South Korean man and his mother-in-law were taken from their home in the village of Oda on Monday evening. Reuters News reports that the man's mobile phone signal was last traced to the border with Ethiopia, but that the phone, along with its tracking device, were switched off. The arid borderlands between Kenya and Ethiopia are awash with weapons and suffer frequent raids by armed groups. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.